I'm Veronica Belmont.
And I'm Tom Merritt.
And this is episode number 27. 27.
Whoa.
I'm taking Spanish courses from iTunes University.
¿Cómo está usted?
You don't need to use the formal with me.
Oh,
I'm
that's
your friend.
True.
¿Qué tal? ¿Cómo está?
¿Qué pasa?
¿Qué pasa? Anyway, this is a science fiction fantasy podcast, not a Spanish language podcast.
No,
so we have just, we're going to get to this in a little bit, but we did finally finish reading Mists of Avalon.
Yes!
Woohoo!
Wow, that was a long book.
Yeah, you, me, and like 17 other people in the club.
Yes,
managed to get through it. Maybe.
Apologize. Anyone who didn't read Mists of Avalon, we'll get through some quick burns, and then you can fast forward through to the feedback portion of the
Wait,
show.
Did we pick Mists of Avalon when we were at Dragon Con?
No.
Weren't we talking about that at Dragon Con?
We were talking about it, but we didn't pick it yet because we hadn't finished summing up the Forever War.
All right, good. You're
yeah.
right. Whew. I was getting nervous there for
no,
a second.
No, we announced it in October.
Did it take us
we
longer
it in
to
September,
read
though.
Mists of Avalon than it took to read Anathem?
Yeah, it might have. It might. I was thinking of Anathem while I was reading this too, because Anathem, I remember I actually stayed home from work. I don't remember
did?
If I was. I don't remember if I was sick or if I was. I think I was sick actually. Like luckily, and I just stayed home and just read Anathem. Or maybe it was one of those holidays, those weird holidays. But I just read it all day long, and I was like, "That's what I have to do to get through the Mists of Avalon." Not that it wasn't good, but it's just long.
Well, that's what happened with me. I read it over the Thanksgiving break.
Mm-hmm.
We left town, got out of the city, and I had a lot of free time, and so I just read the whole... And the thing is you couldn't really tell how long it was, because I personally read it on Kindle.
Yeah.
And so I had no conception of what I was getting into.
Boy, did that percentage point tick over slow.
Oh, my God.
Still 30?
Oh, my goddess.
I've been reading all night.
Yeah.
All right, well,
let's get to quick burns.
Yeah. Totally,
man.
Sci-fi author Peter Watts, you may have heard of him. He is the author of the Rifters trilogy and Blindsight, was thrown in jail, and he's in danger of losing his freedom after confronting Border Patrol agents when they were searching his car on the U.S. side of the Canadian border. Peter Watts is Canadian. He was driving across the border. They asked to search his car. The way he tells it, they started searching his car. He got out of the car and said, "What are you doing?" They didn't answer him, so he asked again. And then he says they, you know, grabbed him, put him up against the car, punched him in the face, and hauled him off into jail. They took his computer. They took his storage. They took his notes. They took his jacket, and they let him off on the Canadian side eventually. After a while, without his jacket, in the middle of winter in Canada.
Wow.
So he's upset.
Yeah, I could imagine. The Electronic Frontier Foundation actually found him a civil rights lawyer in Michigan, and he could end up being in a U.S. federal prison for up to 2 years because of this, because he apparently did hit an officer.
Well, it's interesting. The officers at the Border Patrol say... In the write up, that he hit one of their hands with his head,
with his face.
Yeah.
So wait,
he claims,
wouldn't that mean that
he
the
got
guy
punched
hit him
in the face? Yeah. I mean, I guess if you tried to headbutt somebody and you hit a hand, whatever. But
he hit my hand with his face.
It just doesn't sound good. And basically, Peter says the charge is spurious, that he was just given a bad time. Who knows what exactly happened? Maybe he had an attitude and he rubbed somebody the wrong way. Maybe he was shouting a little. But it doesn't sound like he did anything that really warranted the rough treatment he got.
It sounds like abuse.
Yeah.
Basically. Like, it sounds way over the top for what happened. But, of course, we weren't there. So we can't make that kind of judgment call. Ouch, though. That's rough. Canada. Yeah, they're hardcore.
Well, it's the U.S. people.
Oh, right. You're right. It's the U.S. side. Sorry, I'm just looking for a reason to offload on Canadians. My bad. I love Canada.
Anyway, we have a Slashdot posting that links to an IO9 posting that links to a Boing Boing posting, and they all have links to where you can donate to help his defense because he will be taken to court, and it's going to be costly to defend himself against this if you want to. If he's a favorite writer of yours and you want to help him out, we'll put that in the show notes at swordandlaser.com.
Yep, and speaking of IO9, they've posted their 20 best science fiction books of the decade site. A nice little end of decade list here. And
well, you know,
I have not read as many of them as I should have.
The decade doesn't actually end until next year.
Well, actually, Tom. Yeah, you're right. But it's no fun.
I love getting in this argument with people because they're like, what do you mean it's 2010? That's a new decade.
But it's the end of the current decade.
Yeah, and then people just get really mad. Like, yeah. Well, it doesn't matter. This is when I'm celebrating the end of the decade.
It was like, and I was class of 2000, and we were like, we're the last class of the decade.
Of the century,
that
right.
That was actually
yeah.
true, yeah. But anyway, some of the titles include, I don't know how to say that, Acacia? The
Acacia.
War with the Mind.
I think that's Acacia. Acacia? Yeah.
Acacia?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How embarrassing. By David Anthony Durham.
I'll help you with the next one, Air.
Oh, that was easy. The next one, The Alchemy of Stone.
Then there's the Neal Stephenson Baroque Cycle. This is the first one on the list that I've actually read, and I've read the entire Baroque Cycle. It's a mammoth 3-volume set, and I loved it. so if you've got the time, definitely check it out. It's a really great read, really great tromp through history in like the 1700s with science and how science was done back then, and breathes life into that whole era of Isaac Newton and everything in a way that I'd never imagined anybody could. It's really fascinating.
Excellent. And the next one is Confessions of Max Tivoli, which is the book that a lot of people believe is the inspiration for the Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
Right. I'm interested in reading that. Mm-hmm. There's also Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom by Cory Doctorow, which I have also read.
I have started reading it, but I never finished it.
Oh, you should finish it. It's good.
So I should get back into that. The next one is The Execution Channel by Ken MacLeod.
Glass House by Charles Stross.
The Harry Potter series by J.K. Rowling.
Well, she started that in the 90s, series. But I guess she wrote enough of them this decade that it still counts.
Yeah.
I have read all those, too.
It's your turn.
Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Susanna Clarke.
Also another one I started reading and never finished.
Well,
I better
you still
pick it up
got
again.
A few weeks left in the decade.
It was very slow for me. I had a hard time picking it up, but a lot of friends of mine loved it, so maybe I should give it another go.
Look to Windward by Ian M. Banks. The Mount by Carol M. Schwiller.
Oryx and Crake by Margaret Atwood.
Pattern Recognition by William Gibson. I've read that.
Yeah, I read that. Perito Street Station by China. Oh, I don't know how to read her last name.
Mayville. Rainbow's End by Werner Vinge. Stories of Your Life and Others by Ted Chiang.
Time Traveler's Wife. I do want to read that. It came out as a movie, of course. Tooth and Claw.
Have you read that one?
Nope.
It's about a dragon.
There's a dragon on it,
how is
which
it
means
that you
I
have
automatically
not read this,
love it.
And it's about a dragon.
It should have been Temeraire. Oh.
And then World War Z, An Oral History of the Zombie War by Max Brooks, which
definitely
I have read.
Definitely want to read that.
I highly recommend World War Z.
Fantastic. All right, well, this is my new official reading list.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll include a link to that in the show notes as well. And another book to throw in as a new book that just came out, Generation A by Douglas Coupland, is out. And this is sort of a response 20 years, 50 so down the road to Generation X. It's actually an allusion to the Kurt Vonnegut stump speech. Not stump speech, he wasn't campaigning, but he gave a speech to college students in which he scoffed at the term Generation X and suggested they should be called Generation A since they were at the beginning of a series of astonishing triumphs and failures, he said. So Generation A is the name of the latest Coupland book, and he plays with that idea. This is actually set a little bit into the future. It is a science fictionish take on the Douglas Coupland universe. If you've never read any of his book, it's always very pop culture oriented, very much characters that are kind of taken out of alternative scenes. Microsurfs is a great exploration of people in programming or working in tech. But then there's also Miss Wyoming, which is a former beauty queen. And I'm a big fan of Coupland. So I have this book, and I haven't started reading it yet, but I'm looking forward to it. And if you've been always been like, oh, he's a little bit too much of a pop mainstream guy, but you like science fiction, this might be the one for you. The premise is suddenly five people are stung by bees, although bees are almost gone, and so there is no more honey. Fuel is scarce, and then the five people mysteriously stung by bees all have their own stories. So it's kind of built around this dystopian, not too distant future.
Very interesting. They also have a character that is obsessed with World of Warcraft.
Yes, that's one of the characters that gets bitten by bees.
Fantastic.
So you're in, aren't you?
I'm totally in. I am in like Flynn. All right, so now we should get to our discussion of Mists of Avalon. Oh, but by the way, are you going to see Avatar?
I totally am going to see Avatar, yeah.
Are you going to see it opening night?
If nothing else for the technology. I don't know. If my schedule permits, yeah, I want to. It's not like the kind of movie where I have to see it opening night, but I really do want to see it opening night.
I'm going to see Sherlock Holmes opening night.
Oh, that's on Christmas, right? Mm-hmm. Christmas Day? Yeah, I'm totally seeing that.
I can't wait.
Yeah.
But we digress. We'll talk about those after we see them. Mists of Avalon time. So I have to admit that Tom is much more well-versed in Arthurian legend than I am. It's something you actually studied, correct?
I have a whole bookshelf full of books about Roman Britain, Britain between the era of Rome and the Saxon invasion.
Quite a lot of Anglophile stuff
just about Arthur. I was really fascinated with that period, that Roman and post-Roman Britain period. So yeah, when I was taking history classes in college, I studied this a lot, and even afterwards.
Well, I'm going to interview you then.
Okay.
How close would you say that her take on the Arthurian legend is to what we know historically and what has come before?
Well, Veronica, I would call it a leveraged postmodern reimagining of several forms of historic... No,
pastiche, if you will.
Yes, pastiche. Actually, it's really interesting. I like what she did here. I like how she took historical facts and pieces of the legend of Arthur and weaved them together in what comes off as sort of, this is what really happened and what gave rise to the legend.
Yes.
Well, what I mean by that is, like, there's a lot of controversy and there's a lot of different versions of Arthurian legend. There's French versions, there's all these different cyclicals, then there's the Histories of the Kings of Britain by Geoffrey of Monmouth, which is the first sort of historical telling of Arthur that's in the record, and then there's, of course, La Morte d'Arthur by Thomas Malory, which is sort of considered to be the essential romantic telling of Arthurian legend. And so you get a lot of conflicting information. For instance, there's just the character of Merlin. It's like, well, wait a minute, why does this Christian king have a wizard in his court? And he's supposedly immortal, but he's super old, and then he dies, but then he doesn't die, and then he plays the harp, but he didn't play the harp. And it's like, she explains all that. She's like, oh, well, Merlin is a title, which is how it gets confused later on into thinking he's immortal, because there's more than one, and one of them is a harpist, and, you know, and the Merlin is a wizard, and she explains how that whole, you know, well, he's a Christian king, but he still has allegiance to Avalon, and it really struck me as a great background to all of that, and at the same time, she has her own story that she wants to tell.
The characters were very interesting. I mean, it was definitely a pagan way of life versus the, you know, patriarchal Christian way of life. And it was very interesting for me, especially, to see how those two, you know, they could coexist, but for different political reasons and for the driving forces of a lot of the characters, it couldn't happen that way. And it kind of demonized Christianity in a way, and it also demonized paganism in a way. And so I'd be really interested to know what a lot of our readers thought about that. And it was something I thought about a lot while I was reading.
Yeah, I know. It's a complex take. It's not just saying one of these is right and one is wrong, but it shows how people can be led from one belief to another, how that conversion process actually works out and why people do things the way they do. It's not just a moment of epiphany and everybody says, oh, I've been a pagan, that's wrong, I'm going to become a Christian now. It's, you know, some people do it for selfish reasons, some people do it for spiritual reasons, and I liked that. I liked that weaving of it. I was a little less of a fan of some of the And maybe it's because it's paganism and it's supposed to be pagan. And I was raised a Christian and I was raised a Catholic. But the sort of like, she seems to be saying like, well, if you want to be with the true pagan religion, you got to sleep with your sister and your mom and you got to have lots of threesomes.
No, well, no. It's I've like, done a lot of study of paganism and religions of that sort, and it's not really like that. I mean, sexuality does play a big role a lot of the time, but it's definitely not like sleep with your sister, you know, keep the bloodline pure. I mean, I think she was definitely using that as a device to tell this story. And the characters were interesting too, because they were very multidimensional. I mean, there was never a good person or a bad person. They always had these different motivations and things that changed their allegiances and how they felt and how they acted. And ultimately, a lot of them weren't that likable.
Yeah, everybody had so many flaws that, you know, even Arthur, who's he's the hero of the myth, right? Mm-hmm. Even he turns out to be kind of like a jerk at times.
Well, he was kind of a, like, he was so easily swayed by everyone.
Especially by Guinevere. You know, you're so upset with her, first of all, for constantly, like, you think she's about to get a spine and stand up for something, and then she, like, totally falls under the sway of the priests again, and then she becomes the raving, like, no, everything that's not, you know, the Christian church is evil, and just pushes him around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he went with it. And he felt kind of weak-spined in that way. Like, yeah, mm-hmm. sure, he was a great warrior, and he was a good leader of men. But at the end of the day, it was all these people just kind of whispering in his ear, and Guinevere especially, telling him what he should do.
I thought the relationship of Lancelot, Arthur, and Guinevere was very real. Mm-hmm. And that's why it bugged me the whole thing where it seemed to romanticize incest in some cases, because I thought, well, why did you have to go that far? Because I liked the real, like, hey, you know what? Sometimes you could be wedded to some one person, but still have feelings for another. And those feelings are real. And it doesn't mean you don't love this one person. And I was like, that is a, you know, thing that any high school student
well, I mean, don't you think they acted,
understands, right?
But don't you think that in the incest storyline, if you will, Morgause and Arthur were very unhappy about it? I mean, it wasn't something they were interested in or continuing in any way.
But later,
I mean,
in the book,
it was just a device that Vivian. I don't know why I couldn't say that. It was just a device that Vivian used to keep the bloodline pure and to make sure that there was still a tie to Avalon.
But later in the book, when Morgaine, it seems to be thinking a lot about the difference between the church and the old ways, the fairy ways, she starts to soften up and be like, well, you know, this incest thing, I shouldn't even be, I'm hung up on it because I was raised with all these Christians around. I should be free to do whatever I want. No one should judge me. And so it starts to become like, she doesn't like it, but then she starts to use it as a justification, I felt like, a little bit.
I guess. Yeah, I don't think I got that as much.
The only character that really bugged me was Egraine.
Yeah.
And the reason Egraine bugged me is because she's an excellent character at the beginning of the book. She's so strong. She's not at first, right? She's very weak, but she finds her strength, mm-hmm. and then she finds her love, and then she goes to Uther, and then she has all those dreams of Atlantis, and you're just like, wow, this is a really deep and interesting character with a big life change. And then all of a sudden, the next time you see her, she's practically a nun.
I know, and she's been a total jerk to her kids.
I'm like,
and
what
the only thing in her life is Uther at that point. And she just becomes a you know, super Christian.
But Uther wasn't even all that much of a Christian. I just didn't buy that woman who had gone through that transformation and had dreams of Atlantis just suddenly becomes, like, super Christian out of nowhere.
It was weird. And then she went back the other
way. Yeah, exactly.
Later.
And then at the end, you came back, and I'm like, okay, that's the Egraine I remember.
Yeah, it was kind of weird.
Yeah, I'm not sure I bought that.
But I wish I had learned more about Morgause and her evil dark magic.
Morgause. Yeah.
These are the way I say things in my head when I'm reading them.
Right.
Yes.
The one up in Orkney.
Yeah. And then she just went, I mean, she was kind of, you know, she had that evil tinge to her throughout the whole story. I mean, you saw it just even when she was a kid.
She was always kind of practical. Like, ooh, what can I get advantage for myself? I don't care.
And I kind of respected that of her in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did a little bit. Like, I was like, okay, she's a girl who knows what she wants. She's not, she understands what's going on in her household. She is very, you know, she wants the power. But she never did anything too terrible. I mean, she had ideas of things she wanted to do. And for one reason or another, they never went the way she wanted them to.
Right.
Except, well, I mean, I guess unless... Did she have something to do... Did her and Lot have something to do with Arthur falling off the horse?
You know, they never... It was sort of like left to your imagination. I don't think that was ever... I don't remember anyway that that was ever cleared up. I don't think they pointed at them. Mm-hmm. But Lot was definitely sort of like, he could have done it. He could have wanted to do it.
I mean, if something happened to him, I mean, I wouldn't be too upset. But then at the end, she goes nutso, crazy, killing people for blood magic type of stuff. And it's like, whoa, where did this come from?
Well, I kind of, it was a big, big change, but I felt like it was a logical change. Like, she just gets desperate and she's old and trying to cling to her youth and her hold over Gwydion II.
Gwydion II, Mordred,
Mordred, so I bought it, though. I bought that she slid into that, because she was always frustrated at her lack of the sight, and why she wasn't trained in Avalon, but Morgaine was, and so I felt like that, to her, was a way of showing, like, I can have power, you know, I'm tired of living in the shadows.
Yeah. So overall, I enjoyed the book. It did definitely have some lagging moments for me, but it picked up.
I had this weird thing where I kept falling asleep every time I read it. Not out of boredom, but I would just get lulled. Like, there's something in that tone or that rhythm that just, it was one of the reasons it took me so long to read it.
Yeah, I read before I go to bed every night, and I usually fall asleep mid-book, which is fun because now I'm reading Sherlock Holmes stories. And so I fall asleep to Sherlock Holmes, and then I have dreams about mysteries. And
that's kind of cool.
Fun. So what did you think overall?
Overall,
something you would recommend to people?
I'd give it one sword, one laser up, or whatever our rating system is going to be. Yeah.
Do we have a rating system?
No, I just made that up. I'd give it two lasers. Oh wait! Well, you give this one a sword.
You give it a sword.
I'd give it a good recommendation. I would warn people how long it is and be like, you know, you need to dig in for this. You need to really want it. But I recommended it to Leo Laporte because he was like, "Oh, is it about unicorns and magic?" And I was like, "No, it's actually more of a realistic telling of what really happened behind the Arthurian legend, and there's a little bit of magic here and there, but it's not, but I like the fact that most of the magic is like, oh, those are just tricks, you know, charms work for the little people because they don't know much, but if you're at all educated, you probably want to stay away from them.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and if you want to go back and read up on the characters and try to keep everyone straight, there's a really thorough Wikipedia page on it, and I'm sure you can find lots more information on the web too. And she wrote more books.
Yeah, there were some books in the series, right?
Mm-hmm. No, I think she wrote more books after, didn't she? I mean, there was
Marion Zimmer Bradley wrote
Ancestors
lots of, books,
of Avalon, Ravens of Avalon.
That's what I meant in the series.
Oh, I thought you meant the books
Avalon.
Within the book that we just read, because it was broken up into parts.
Correct. No, I just meant in the universe, I suppose you would put.
Yes. I'd like to, I wouldn't mind maybe checking out one of those just because it would be interesting to see where they take the story from there.
Mm-hmm.
Because it did seem to have a pretty definitive end.
Well, yeah, and the Arthurian legend ends sort of like that, depending on which one you read. I mean, there is the idea of
prequels.
The once and future king is the one thing that I don't like about the way this ended. It changes that once and future king thing, and that's one of the things I love about Arthurian legend, is that idea that Arthur is... still might come back, you know?
Yeah. The books that I mentioned are actually prequels, and so they go back into the Atlantis storyline.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, there's a lot of fodder there.
Right. But you know how it ends, so I'm just saying.
Is it ended? I know. Well, she kind of did end it, didn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, hopefully you guys enjoyed it. We will be picking up a new book shortly, but... Final thoughts?
A+.
A+, really?
Oh, okay, A-.
A-, okay.
A minus.
Okay.
You?
It's time now. No. Oh, let me pick up. This is bad. I don't know how to end this segment. Hold on.
Well, just tell me what. Give it your final sum up.
My final sum up. I don't think I would read it again. I would recommend it to people if they were interested in the story of Arthur. But I think there's a lot of other books out there that I would rather go back to. I enjoyed the almost feminist standpoint of the book. It was kind of a nice, refreshing change. I know it turned a lot of people off from the story. A lot of people we spoke to that were also reading it mm-hmm. were like, wow, this is really like way too much estrogen in this book for me to handle.
I didn't feel that.
I kind of liked it. I kind of liked that. It was nice to see this different point of view.
It was a lot of estrogen for sure, but it didn't feel like it tried to emasculate the men. The men characters were still all believable in doing manly men things.
Manly men things. Exactly. Actually, my favorite character was probably Uther.
Yeah, you like Uther? That's funny.
He was one of my favorite characters, and it made me laugh because that was my one of my Warcraft realms was Uther.
We were on the Uther
realm.
When
I first started playing, I was on the Uther realm.
Interesting.
All right, well, it's time now for Barrier Sword, which is feedback from the audience. Josh Lawrence made a music video for
us. He did. I wish we had a video version of Sword and Laser to show this to you, but you'll just have to go to the YouTube link yourself. He took the Sword and Laser song by Clive Royal.
Mm-hmm. He did a remix of that song.
He did.
Or someone else's remix.
Yeah, he took a remix of that song and then put science fiction pulp pictures to it that go along with the lyrics. So these are all like classic era 40s and 50s type art that follows along with the lyrics of the song. It's really incredible.
Yeah, it must have taken forever to find all those images. Very impressed. So thank you, Josh, for that. And we also have a discussion from Mike Minutillo about finishing books. If you start a book and you just can't get into it, do you just keep going? If you put a book down, do you pick it up again and finish it? What do you do in that situation?
I am a finisher. I persist thinking like, you know what I usually is like, even if I'm not enjoying the writing or there's characters that annoy me, I usually still am so curious about how the story turns out, where the story is going, mm-hmm. that I keep hammering away at it. And the only books I don't really finish are ones where the story actually bails. And if you don't care about the story, then forget it.
I bail a lot.
You're a bailer?
I'm a bailer. I start a book, I read it through the first few chapters, and if it doesn't grab me, unless I'm forced to read it for like the book club, I just move on to the next thing. And I leave it nearby, like on the bedside table, with the hopes that I will soon pick it up again. But a lot of times I don't. And that's what happened with Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. I got into the first like four chapters and I was like, wow, not doing it for me. And I felt bad, but you know, there's so many good books out there that I feel like I'm wasting time sometimes.
Wombat did that with Mists of Avalon. He said he'd had it on his bookshelf for a quarter of a century, but could never get past the first 100 pages. So he figured he'd try it again when we picked it as the Sword and Laser book, but he gave up again. He says there's just too many better books he wants to read to persist with something that doesn't grab him.
Yeah, I feel ya. I feel ya there, Wombat.
Yeah.
And then we have another discussion on the Atlantis thing, and this is from Shimmer, and she says, I haven't read a lot of retellings of Arthurian legend other than the classics, but has Atlantis been connected with this before now? And that was something I didn't realize either. I had no idea that they were tied. Are they?
They aren't usually.
Or is that just convenient?
No, that was just, I feel like that might be a Bradley innovation. Mike Minutillo again points out that the Pendragon Cycle by Stephen R. Lawhead makes a connection to Atlantis, but he points out that came out 5 years after Mists of Avalon, so it could be playing on that connection. But yeah, Atlantis is usually not involved. Now, some Arthurian legend traces Arthur's lineage to Troy, mm-hmm. and that he is a descendant of Troy, and there's always Roman connections to lots of Roman myth.
Well, they did mention... they did mention a lot of Roman stuff in Mists of Avalon, for sure. I mean, even the old myths, they came back to a lot, like Achilles.
Yeah, yeah.
I think came up a couple times.
Well, it's supposed to be the remnants of a Roman civilization, right. the Roman colony of Britannia.
Yeah. So we do have to pick another book, though.
Yes. So, yeah, our next episode will probably be in the new year. and we will kick off another book. But instead of just, I mean, it's time for a laser one, and maybe the next one will be a laser one. But instead of just dictating a laser one next, I figure we'll take that top 20 list from IO9. What do you think?
I think that's a great idea. And have someone, and have the forum members pick their favorite choice.
Yeah, let's put a link in the forums at swordandlaser.ning.com and have people, not exactly a vote, but, you know, make a nomination speech. Put an argument of why Gravity's Rainbow or World War Z or a Harry Potter book or whatever.
No, Harry. Maybe we should not do Harry Potter.
We should probably not do Harry Potter. So you're
Harry
really going to have
exempt.
To be persuasive if you want Harry Potter.
Also the...
The Baroque Cycle. We're definitely doing the Baroque Cycle because you have to read the whole thing. And even one volume of the trilogy is as big as Mists of Avalon, if not bigger. So
we have donated a lot of time to Neal Stephenson, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, I think we need to steer clear of those. But really, anything that you can persuade us into picking as our next book, make your case of the top 20 books of the decade. And I think it'd be fun.
Great. All right, and before we leave, we do want to mention our new partner, StickerFoo. Use the code SWORD1 and get 10% off of their geeky fantastic stickers at www.stickerfoo.com.
Speaking of Harry Potter, you can be, you know, Gryffindor in the sticker in the back of your car.
I need a car so I can get the sticker. I guess I could just stick it to my bike.
If enough people use the code SWORD1 at stickerfoo.com, you might be able to buy a car.
I don't think so, but that's wishful thinking.
I mean, it would be a lot of people, I know. But
a lot of people. If you guys want to contribute, you can email us at theswordandlaser@gmail.com. Visit our website at theswordandlaser.com. And check out the Ning group at swordandlaser.ning.com. We have lots of good discussions going on there.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thank you. See you next time.
The Sword and the Laser.